Back together again, you and I chatting it up, brand new week, Monday style, August 4th, 2025 on Connecticut Today. I looked at the relative silence from state Democrats regarding the latest revelations in the Bridgeport absentee ballot scandal. We also chatted with GOP State Senator Rob Sampson and former Republican State Senate member John McKinney about those same revelations. Multi-time Connecticut Sportscaster of the Year, Rich Coppola, and Quinnipiac University Assistant Professor of Management, Dr. Don McCauley, dropped by to discuss the possible move to Boston by the WNBA's Connecticut Sun. And finally, CBS News White House reporter Willie James Inman dropped by to talk about the continued controversy surrounding last week's lackluster national jobs report. So as I often do, kind of reading, soaking in as much as I can over the weekend about the latest news, including this Bridgeport absentee ballot mess that we've been talking about, seems like, for the last 30 or 40 years. And I had a question, pop in my mind. And before we get to that question, I was really encouraged by an editorial published by Hearst Connecticut Media from the editorial board of the Republican American in Waterbury. And again, this showed up on the CT Insider site here now. And it kind of makes you wonder even more and more and more and more why people, or maybe you know the answer, maybe this is all rhetorical. I don't know. You tell me as we get into this. But isn't it sad that there is a deafening silence from so many of our so-called leaders, as our friend Chris Caruso said on Friday? I was thinking about his remarks and thinking about this over the weekend. Where's the leadership on this? Where is the leadership, especially from the Democratic Party, the Democratic elders, the leaders in the state here? And I know what they're going to say. Well, we can't comment on pending investigations and pending litigations. All right, I get that. I understand it. You do what your lawyers tell you. I get that. I understand it. I really do. And to a point, I respect that. But with these latest revelations that are much more serious than some rogue people just handling or mishandling ballots, this apparently is all we've gotten so far from Governor Ned Lamont on this. This is a statement he sent to our friends at News 8. The governor saying a couple of days ago, quote, "Those who commit election fraud ought to be held accountable, as these actions only erode the trust and confidence the public has in our elections. We put reforms and measures in place to ensure this does not happen and will continue to work toward building greater faith in our local elections," unquote. So I guess that's it. We have no news conference. We have no gathering, no mass gathering of majority Democrats in Hartford, or maybe even in Bridgeport. How about some Democrats in Bridgeport? How about the Bridgeport delegation to the state House and state Senate? Why don't they issue a statement? Have they? If they did, I apologize. Email it to me or send it to me in a text. Why so quiet, everybody? Oh, why is everybody in the mode here? It's sad, isn't it? So I was thinking about this over the weekend. Then I read this editorial that was published by Hearst Connecticut Media in the Connecticut Insider. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but a couple of paragraphs really hit home with me. I'll give you this one here. Listen to this. And boy, I got to tell you, this is one of the best things written in this so far. If the current allegations are true, the public can be sure that the fraud was not committed by some rogue crackpot. No, it was allegedly a concerted, somewhat sophisticated effort by powerful, well-connected city officials. It's the kind of thing many other powerful, well-connected people in national politics and media hand wave away as a practically mythical phenomenon. The real conspiracy, the public is often told, is the effort to fortify elections against the kind of fraud investigators say they found. But while the alleged conspiracy involved five people connected to Bridgeport politics, no one could call it widespread. That is starting to change. The editorial goes on, quote, of the four people arrested, two were charged with failure to sign as assister on an absentee ballot. Three are charged with misrepresenting eligibility requirements for voting by absentee ballot. They continue here. All four are charged with possession of ballots and envelopes restricted. That means they allegedly ran afoul of state law governing the proper procedures of absentee voting. And yes, this is me talking now, not the editorial. And yet, we are told by all the different campaigns, right? We're told by all these campaigns, well, they're told the rules. Well, they should know the rules. Now, wait a minute. This keeps happening, and we keep hearing, well, they know the rules. Well, either they don't know the rules, either people who say they know the rules are not being honest with us, or if those people are honest, then you're explaining it to somebody who either doesn't understand the rules or hears the rules and says, screw you. So which is it here? You tell me. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Give me another paragraph before we take a break here, and I'll open with our Facebook question. Republican American, thankfully still a conservative, I know, egads, a conservative editorial board in this state, I know, may make some people break out in hives. They write, quote, norms exist for a reason, even if those reasons aren't obvious to people who've benefited from them their entire lives. It's no different from the old cliche about fish not noticing water. With basic electoral norms carelessly tossed aside, the floodgates are open for fraud. If, and again, stressing if, this is me talking now, innocent till proven guilty, if the evidence is there in the Bridgeport case, prosecutors have a duty to counterbalance the state's reckless policies by prosecuting the defendants to the fullest extent possible. Period. That's the end of what I'm going to read from the op-ed. Thank you, Republican American Editorial Board. And Paulie, your humble little host here, I agree with that. If this is as bad as it's starting to sound, and we get no connection or disconnection between supposedly what these campaigns say they told their people and what their people do, I don't care who it is, I don't care how old the person is, I don't care how high this goes, to maintain election credibility in this state, especially with the notion now that we're going to get more widespread, no-excuse absentee ballots here. You have got to drop the hammer on these people like it's never been dropped before. Which leads me to my question before we take a break here. At 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, ask yourselves this. And I know they're going to say, well, the case is still being litigated. Okay, you don't have to name names. You don't have to be specific about it. Ask yourselves this. And you tell me, talk or text to 333-9422 or go to our Facebook page. You tell me, why aren't more state Democrats speaking up about the latest revelations surrounding the Bridgeport absentee ballot allegations? It almost sounds like that was a horse crap statement put out by Governor Lamont because, I don't know, I guess I got to say something about it. Yes, Governor, good. But you tell me, let me ask you this. Where's the outrage from the Bridgeport delegation? Where are the Bridgeport State Senate members? Where are the Bridgeport State House members saying they're appalled by this? I don't know. Maybe they're not appalled? Yeah, thank you, Mr. Announcer. Yeah, my first question of the day and of the week here, 203-333-9422. 9422-333-WICC, talk or text. Hey, why aren't more state Democrats speaking up about the latest revelations surrounding the absentee ballot mess in Bridgeport? The new allegations now, and again, these are only allegations. I get it. I understand it. Innocent until proven guilty. But, you know, I was thinking on the break there, it seems like, and I know I'm being a little facetious here, but it seems like every time Donald Trump farts, William Tong has something to say about it. Our esteemed Attorney General, Mr. Tong, seems to be outraged. Maybe everything what Trump does, including a spate of presidential flatulence. He'll put out a news release. He'll hold a news conference. Has he said anything about this? Again, the governor put out kind of that half-hearted press release, and I get it, I understand it, he asked to do it. Have we heard anything on the Bridgeport allegations, the new ones, from, I don't know, Susan Bisewitz, who herself may become governor or U.S. senator someday? Have we heard about that? Has Madam Lieutenant Governor said anything about this? I don't think so. And again, I often and always invite you that if I'm wrong on this stuff, please let me know. 333-9422, talk or text or email Paul, P-A-U-L, Paul, at voiceofct.com. Where's the House leadership on this? Matt Ritter, Jason Rojas, have they said anything since the revelations last week? Oh, our friends in the Senate. The two old guys like Statler and Waldorf up on the Muppet balcony. Where's Bob Duff? Where's Martin Looney on this? Have they said anything? Maybe they have. Go ahead and tell me. At 333-9422, 333-WICC. If they're against this stuff, which I am assuming they are, if they're against that stuff, and I'm assuming they are, why haven't we seen it said in any more formal news releases? Why doesn't the Democratic Party leadership in this state hold a news conference? I'm sure all the radio stations, all the TV stations, all the online folks, all the micro sites will end up going there and covering it. Great way, guys and gals, to get your message out. Yet nothing. You know why? They probably have no problem with it. Well, why would you say that, Paul? Because what the hell else are people in Bridgeport supposed to think? What are they supposed to think? So again, I ask a simple question here, and you folks who don't often agree with me, you folks who say, oh, the Republicans this, the Republicans that, what about your side of the aisle right now? What do you have to say? Anything you do say from word one will be a lot more than your leadership is saying. Can you say something? Hello? Is this thing on? Oh, my God. Again, my question, and I know you're going to hear this, and people are going to say, well, Paul, you know the answer. Yeah, I know the answer, which is why I want to hear it from your lips, not mine. Why do you suppose more state-level Democrats are not speaking out about the latest revelations surrounding, and again, these are still allegations, I get it, around Bridgeport Democrats? As Connecticut and as the city, not the good people who live in the city of Bridgeport and bust their tails and work every day, but what it echoes like around in the area. I told you, I have very progressive left-leaning friends in the news business who message me at night. We chat back and forth, some on a more regular basis than others, and almost all of them, a lot of them card-carrying Democrats, say to me, WT, you know what? Why is this tolerated? And I said, well, because it is. Well, Republicans should sound the alarms. I say, yes, they are, and they get brushed aside like Tuesday's dandruff. And it ain't going to stop until people, you know, sit back and say, well, maybe I should vote for different people. I don't know. Although it doesn't seem to be just one campaign here. Just saying. So you tell me, why are a lot of people in the state Democratic Party leadership so freaking spineless over this? And I'm not saying they've got to throw somebody under the bus. I'm not saying they've got to go up there and say something that their lawyer would say, don't say that. Okay, fine. But you know what? You can at least come out and say, can you not? The governor can get in front of a microphone, the lieutenant governor, you know, William Tong, when he's not busy filing the 83rd lawsuit against the Trump White House after 48 others. Can't they say, hey, this is really disturbing and we fully support the investigation? Do they? I don't know. Sure doesn't sound like it. Hey, Rob Sampson. Rob, I tried to come up with a segue for that, but I can't. Good afternoon, Rob. How are you, sir?
I am well, Paul, and thank you very much for continuing to hammer this issue of election integrity. It's something super important to me that I've been hammering away at for what seems like a decade now, and still nothing but inaction from the majority.
Yeah, Rob, and I mentioned earlier, just to put this in perspective, and thank you for the decade mentioned, Rob. It's been 6 years now since the first, I don't want to say the first, but the really solid allegations of 2019 all the way through 2025. That is 6 years. Rob, even I know World War II with the U.S. lasted 4 years. It took us 6 years to get men from rockets that wouldn't blow up on the launch pad at NASA to orbiting the moon on Apollo 8. Yet, Rob, in some way, shape, or form, and it's sad that this goes on for the good law-abiding people of Bridgeport. We have here, let's be fair, allegations, innocent until proven guilty, of stuff that you say has been going on like 10 years or allegedly has been going on here. Rob, I don't get this. I just don't understand.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the majority clearly prefers the status quo. The shame of this whole thing is we're going to have another municipal election in a few months and nothing will have changed. And this will just continue on in perpetuity unless the people of Connecticut really demand action from the governor, who's never seemed to put a lot of impetus or pressure on the legislature to enact any true measures to ensure election integrity. I mean, he gives it a lot of lip service, but at the end of the day, he's not putting any pressure on anyone to do it. And the two chairmen of the Government Administration and Elections Committee, which is Senator Mae Flexer and Representative Matt Blumenthal, who I'm proud to call out by name because they need to be called out by name, they have failed to move the policies that show up in committee that are offered by the minority, including myself, year after year. They fail to bring these through the committee process, and they fail to bring them up on the floor, even when we do find agreement on some minor issue like the bill that you referenced just before your break.
Yeah, yeah. And Rob, let's talk about that, because I had remembered seeing that story. I remember talking about it when it happened, and I started mentioning it again last week, and a bunch of people said, hey, they messaged me, send me that story. I never knew about that. So, Rob, this apparently was you were the Republican supporter, or one of many, of a bill that supposedly had bipartisan support, we're told, House and Senate, about restricting anybody, if they were convicted, Rob, in court, of funny business with absentee ballots. This would have, what, prohibited them from handling or distributing ballots for a dozen years, right, 12 years. And yet, this turned into, what, kabuki theater at the end with the Democratic leaders pointing at each other? What was going on here?
Right. Seems like a pretty basic common sense policy. I mean, if we can't all but get behind something like that, then what exactly are we doing in Hartford? So, you know, everyone gave it lip service on the majority side that mm-hmm. they're in support and, oh, yes, we're going to move this bill. And at the end of the day, when it didn't happen, they tried to come back on me to suggest that somehow me, one of the 11 out of 36 members of the Senate minority is responsible for, quote unquote, blocking a policy that I support, that I've been advocating for years. It's just absurd. You know, they point to the fact that I had offered many other types of election integrity policies, and I want my day in the sun. I want to be able to offer these amendments on the floor, like, you know, voter ID and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I was never going to hold up that legislation. They know that. They're just trying to make me into a boogeyman rather than actually move the policy that the people of Connecticut deserve.
Rob, why don't we, maybe I shouldn't say ever here, so let me amend myself. Why don't we ever or rarely hear any sort of pointed commentary on this from the men and women in you know, the greater Bridgeport delegation that you may see all the time in Hartford. Why are they so silent on this, do you think?
It is remarkable, Paul. I cannot even describe it to you. I remember when Senator Marilyn Moore served in the Senate with me a few years ago, and I brought up amendments that would have addressed the Bridgeport issue, you know, bills regarding the distribution of absentee ballots and things like that. And she voted against these. And I questioned her right on the floor. Why would you oppose this legislation that clearly affected your own run for mayor that had happened a couple of years earlier? And, you know, she was without comment. And to this day, I would love an answer to that question. I guess they think that, you know what, they'll put up with it as far as the problems that happen within the Democratic primary, knowing that they benefit in a general election.
Rob, and the guest, of course, is Rob Sampson, Republican State Senate member. Rob, I am frankly frightened, and I tell this to my audience all the time, that we, and it's going to take a while, I get it, we're going to eventually go to no-excuse absentee ballots in this state, statewide, which you and I know, and I explain to people, is essentially mail-in balloting. And I have no doubt that we will not do it, Rob, the way other states have done it, with a timed, precise plan laid out, putting in layers of security. And I can just imagine what the chances are or the opportunities will be, not just in Bridgeport now, but on a statewide basis, Rob, unless we really clean up our acts to abuse this whole thing.
You're absolutely right, Paul. I mean, it is truly a mess. We already have a constitutional amendment now for no excuse absentee voting. Effectively, it's in play currently, and we do not have the same protections that other states have that do a fair amount of mail-in voting, like signature verification or requiring that you have a copy of your driver's license included with your ballot application and so on. Things that actually preserve the integrity of the vote, not to mention that our voter rolls, which, as you remember, during the pandemic resulted in some folks receiving, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 ballot applications to their home, you know, for a previous residence, people that had passed, you know, the dog. It's just unbelievable. And that kind of thing is going to continue unless there's a concerted effort to address it. We need, you know, people in this state who are in leadership roles to actually address this issue in a big way. I'm very hopeful that we have a strong candidate for governor on the Republican side, and I'm pushing my good friend Ryan Fazio to run for governor because he's the kind of guy who will take the Democrats to task on this issue and a lot of other things.
And you know, finally, Rob, we look at this scenario, and people always say to me, and you've probably heard this too, hey, no election is perfect. Our own Secretary of the State said that. And to a point, Rob, I kind of agree. But I keep telling people also, you look at some election results, and it's amazing how tight, maybe not in the state Senate where you are, but some of these state House races and even some of these municipal races. You know, Rob, we're in a age now where a couple of dozen bad or phony or improper votes can decide who wins and who loses. This is not like we're talking about gaps here of several hundred votes all the time.
Right. You know, right within my Senate district in the town of Southington, there is a state representative district, the 81st, that was decided by one vote. Wow. Just not this most recent cycle, but the one before that. And you go ahead and you look at the Bridgeport issue and you wonder to yourself whether or not this thing is going on at any level in any other place. And I'm going to tell you, it most certainly is. I mean, to what degree? Is it one ballot? Is it three? Is it 100? I don't know. But when you have elections that are decided by these very, very slim margins, we owe it to the voters to make sure that we're employing every last bit of procedure to make sure that we can trust our election results. And that's just not happening. And the majority Democrats know it, and they just don't care.
Rob Sampson, State Senate Republican. Rob, thanks. Appreciate it. Be good, and we'll chat down the road, my friend. Thank you.
Always my pleasure. Thanks, Paul.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Joining us right now, you see him regularly on the Capitol Report on WTNH News 8 on the weekend. Former Fairfield County State Senator John McKinney joining us. Hey, John, good afternoon. Once again, good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Notice some of the stuff you were saying, John. Pretty serious you set up yourself on Sunday regarding the latest wave, and this stuff does come in waves, about the ongoing Bridgeport absentee ballot scandal and this latest news that we got last week, very well covered in particular by the Connecticut Mirror. Some of the stuff mentioned, John, in these documents and allegations, I don't know about you, I was reading and going, wow, that's pretty bad stuff. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it is pretty bad stuff, and you're right. Andrew Brown, Dave Altomare did a great story in the Connecticut Mirror. Obviously, Brian Lockhart, you know, with Hearst, does a terrific job covering all of this for Bridgeport, too. But, you know, you now have four more people who've been arrested and charged with absentee ballot harvesting illegally. And three of the new people all were paid and worked for the Joe Ganim campaign. So you're starting to see, you know, a lot of people who may be facing potential, criminal convictions here. And you know how these things work, Paul. These seem to be lower level campaign employees who are paid by the campaign. And I'm sure the prosecutors, I've read the warrants. They're very thorough. They've done their homework. And the prosecutor is going to sit down with these defendants and their attorneys and say, listen, here's where we have. You're going to be found guilty. Here are the consequences. And hopefully there will be consequences. But they're also going to ask them, who told you to do this? Is there anybody higher up the food chain? Because if you give us information, there may be leniency for that. So there's a lot in these new warrants that are kind of shocking and surprising, and potentially could lead to sort of bigger fish being in jeopardy.
John, also, the thing that drives me nuts, and I've touched on this for the past couple of days, is the repeated mantra, and not just from this round, but we've been hearing this for years. The tops of the campaigns always say, well, we tell them, you know, we tell them not to do this, and we tell them, and by the way, we tell them. And then you hear the lower level people that got caught and said, well, yeah, OK, I did it a couple of times. So, John, riddle me this, bad man. They're either and again, innocent until proven guilty. But the way I understand this, John, either they're not telling them, or if some of these people are told, to me, they either don't get it, don't understand it, or there are other people saying, hey, don't worry about what they told you. Here's what we're going to do. I mean, this to me flies in the face of common sense here.
Well, Paul, it's probably a little bit of a combination of everything you just said there, right? Joe Ganim certainly has a very public past that people have seen with his mistakes. I would be very shocked if he had any knowledge of this. But it's probably purposeful not to have the candidate know how these things work. Mm-hmm. I also think, you know, some of these sort of lower level campaign workers who are getting paid are probably being taken advantage of by the people who are running the campaigns. But I think, you know, I think what I hear, Paul, and I'm so frustrated, and I hear it in your voice too, is that, you know, when you do this, you're stealing votes away from other people who are voting the correct way. You're corrupting our system. And we need some of these people to be held accountable, given prison sentences, go to jail. And that's how you really can scare people from doing this in the future. And if that were to happen to a lower level employee, we're going to start to, I think, have the attorneys for those lower level campaign volunteers say, listen, you don't want to go to jail. You are kind of used here and taken advantage of. So let's tell them everything that happened and go after the people who are orchestrating this. Because, you know, Paul, I've lived in Fairfield and Westport and next to Bridgeport my whole life.
Yeah.
This type of stuff has been rumored to be going on and, quite frankly, has been going on in Bridgeport for way too long. Mm-hmm. This isn't by accident. We always knew, you know, during the Gomes-Ganim primary, the first one, that it was going to come down to the absentee ballots. Why? Because that's just how business was done in Bridgeport, and it's time to start, you know, stop that from happening in the future. And I think state's attorney's office is taking this very, very seriously.
John McKinney is the guest for a couple more minutes. John, you know, I have a dear friend. We still keep in touch from college. And one of the things he used to like to say when we were out enjoying ourselves or trying to figure out a problem somewhere at our college radio station, he used to yell, do something, even if it's not the right thing, even if it's wrong. And John, the I don't want to say inability, but the apparent intransigence or willingness of the Democratic majorities in Hartford to almost literally do nothing about this is, to me, appalling and just an insult to the good people of Connecticut.
It is frustrating. And quite frankly, look, you know, and things are actually changing a little bit, Paul, on the electoral map. And we could talk about that maybe at another time. But it was always, you know, Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven are going to come in with big numbers. We're not going to know the vote totals because it takes them so long to count. But that's what carried Dan Malloy into office in 2010, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Governor Lamont won overwhelmingly in his second race. Not with great numbers out of Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven, but really running up the score in so many of the suburban towns around the state where, you know, sort of the newer base of the Democratic Party is coming from. But because, you know, Bridgeport, with all its delegates, has more delegates to the Democratic Convention, I think, than any other city and town, because of its importance to Democratic elections, they have not been as serious about this as they should.
John McKinney. John, thank you, my friend. Always good. We'll chat down the road again and have a happy rest of the week. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Appreciate it. John McKinney there. There you go. Former, longtime, highly visible state senator from Stratford. It appears on this Monday, the 4th of August, 2025, by all likelihood and all reports we're hearing, the WNBA's Connecticut Sun will only be here in the state one more year and then go to Boston for the season after next. Yes, Connecticut does have pro sports franchises, but the major leagues now about to elude us again. Of course, a lot of people still licking their wounds with the exit decades ago of the Hartford Whalers. We're going to talk about this with a couple of guests this hour. We'll get to the economic aspect of it in a little while, but to just talk about the fandom aspect, the sports aspect, what this makes Connecticut feel like. Is Connecticut ever going to be a major league state? My longtime buddy and pal, I think we've known each other 42 years. He's currently the Director of Administration and Management and Economic Development for the great town of East Haven. Of course, you know him from years on radio and television, a multi-time Connecticut Sportscaster of the Year. We've shared many a broadcast booth together. My buddy, Rich Coppola. Rich, how are you, sir?
Good morning, Paul. Or good afternoon, Paul, I should say. It feels like morning. You know, thank you for reaching out to me. It's really a pleasure to speak to your listeners. You know, it feels like, boy, we've been down this road before.
Yeah.
You obviously mentioned the Hartford Whalers, but, you know, those of us from the New Haven County area know that we've been through this with minor league hockey teams as well. We've been through this with minor league baseball teams. But, you know, when it's the major league teams and you feel like you're a major league state, this would be another black eye. But I don't know that you could say it's the fault of, you know, the fans for lack of support. I think this time it's a little bit different, but, you know, I can't say that I can speak as someone who has been able to follow this every day as I would, you know, if I was still in the sports director's seat.
Yeah.
I've been separated from that for quite a while now. But as someone who loves sports and loves the state, I hate to see this happen. But I question, though, from the league standpoint, and it seems from what I've heard and read that the Sun have reached out because they want to sell. Would this not be, and they're expanding the WNBA, is why not create a New England rivalry between Connecticut and Boston?
Interesting, Rich. I did see that. And look, it's ironic, too. I believe I read that this coming season is the first season. Now, we all know the Mohegan Sun building is a great building. I've been there for plenty of concerts. I know you have, too. You have a scenario here where, you know, you have a building that's a little smaller, but apparently they did really well and they sold out their season tickets this year, if I read that. So that's kind of sad and confusing to your point.
You know, and Paul, I wish I knew, and I don't know the answer to this. How does the WNBA, when they give attendance figures, is it paid tickets? Is it tickets distributed? Now, certainly, when you're talking a casino at any time, in the lore of getting you know, people to come in there and gamble. I know some tickets were given away. I don't know how many, nor do I know if they go in the actual ticket count. But I will say this, for most of the time that the team has been here after moving from Orlando, they really have been, in a lot of ways, a model franchise.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of head-scratching from that standpoint. From an attendance standpoint, I think they did pretty well last year. 2023, they ranked eighth in the league, so they're a little bit lower than midpoint. They averaged over 6,000 fans per game.
Mm-hmm.
In 21, that was the pandemic, and everybody was off. In 2018, the Sun were fifth in the league, 6,700 fans per game. So, you know, they've had tremendous success on the court. Although not winning a championship, they've been bridesmaids on several occasions. You know, off to having a difficult year this year. A lot of their top players left via free agency. But, you know, they've been kind of a model franchise. So
yeah.
It's almost hard to fathom how we end up in this situation.
Especially, Rich, finally, especially in a state that really went a long way, along with Tennessee, of putting women's basketball on the map here as a national phenomenon.
No question about it. And, you know, what you're seeing from the college ranks now is much more competition in the women's game, where, you know, not too long ago it was going to be UConn, Tennessee, just before South Carolina got really good, maybe Notre Dame, and you know, just a handful of teams, and you know, now you've seen scenarios where if you could say the Yankees are in a World Series drought, where UConn was in a women's basketball drought, which any other franchise or college team would be happy about.
Yeah,
it's different with those two. So I know there's been a billionaire interested, and I think the governor has talked about trying to bring the team to Hartford. And, you know, what some of this speaks to in my mind, Paul, is something I said oftentimes during the last years of the Whalers, that if we were to have a new building, around Meriden, where you've got highways converging, more centrally located, I think that might be the answer to, at least a partial answer to some of this, because I know the governor was speaking with people about the NHL, about Phoenix before they moved to Utah. But, you know, in that scenario, you would think, okay, it's probably, you know, a bunch of guys in Fairfield County, and you know, if they're to get involved, would they be more apt to be involved if the team was more central,
maybe,
as opposed to Hartford?
Yeah.
Or you know, I think the building at Mohegan is big enough. There's not a lot of teams that would average more than 10,000, and I think that also gives, you know, somewhat a feeling of, you know, have to get tickets now because, you know, they could sell out. It is kind of catching. And from what you said, I agree with, it certainly appears. And from what you've read, that it's almost like a formality.
Yeah.
And then beginning 2027, we lose them. But they're adding a bunch of teams. Why not keep the Sun put and have the owner in Boston get an expansion for
it? Well, you know, and
I don't.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, I'm starting to hear that more and more. Rich, got to run here. Great stuff. My longtime pal, Rich Coppola, currently the East Haven Director of Admission and Management and Economic Development and a multi-time winner of the Connecticut Sportscaster of the Year. Rich, we'll be seeing each other in a few weeks. That I know when we start to drop the puck. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thanks, Paul.
All right, bye-bye. There you go. Connecticut scorned again as a major league state. Look, we have a lot of professional sports. Understand, you shouldn't really say, well, we don't have any pro sports. No, we have a lot of professional sports. The Hartford Athletic on the AA level of MLS soccer. We have two American Hockey League teams. We have an AA baseball team that plays in the pretty much what people think is one of the best AA stadiums anywhere across the U.S. But we lost the Whalers. It looks like we're going to lose the Connecticut Sun to a big market. So is it a dollar and cents thing? Is it a societal attitude thing? To further discuss the Sun this half hour before we hit news at the top of the hour, Dr. Don McCauley joins us. He's a native of New Haven, proud Hill House High graduate, go academics. He received his doctoral degree in learning, leadership, and education policy at UConn, and he has a master's in sports management from Troy University. Hey, Dr. McCauley, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Paul, thank you for having me.
So, what is your guess here? Business decision, location decision, neither, a little of both? Is it a dollar and cents thing? Why do you think, ironically, we're losing a professional women's basketball team in one of the hotbeds of women's basketball in the world?
You're asking the perfect question. I think it's a combination of all the things that you mentioned. It's pricing, fan attendance. But one thing about Connecticut is that women's basketball is not unfamiliar for us. And for those that are now coming to the party and seeing what's happening over the fence, I think that for us, we are in a smaller market.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems about being in a smaller market is that when we see most of the fans that we're seeing now, they're divided between New York and Boston.
Yeah.
And for us, we're not able to kind of maintain that in a smaller market. So I think about fan attendance. We see the Connecticut Sun doing well across the league. They're not the highest game attendance, but they are close to what the averages are. But also from a capacity standpoint, TD Garden sits there with 19,000.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of individuals are kind of seeing the writing on the wall. They're seeing the expansion of women's sports and the appreciation for it. And then recognizing that, say, we do stay in Connecticut and the Connecticut Sun stay here, we move to Hartford, as your previous caller was talking about. What happens to us if Boston decides to put in a commission for a team?
Mm.
And then now that puts us in a bind, because when we look at some of the ticket sales and numbers, we do recognize that there is a large Massachusetts group that is also participating in our games and coming to Mohegan Sun. And so it creates challenges in terms of where the players are staying, income taxes. But the larger loss for Connecticut is also just having a team where we're able to, for entertainment purposes, growing our youth programs in basketball. And so a large portion of us is like, we don't want to lose this, but is this market too big of an opportunity to lose? Say Boston decides to bring a team in an expansion in the next couple of years.
And also, Doctor, I often try to explain to people, you know, attendance is one thing, revenues, parking, but in this day and age now, you have to have corporate sponsors, right, to say, hey, I'm only going to sign up with your league if you can guarantee me X amount of media impressions or whatever, say, in Connecticut. Is anybody saying that? Because I know they're certainly saying that about Boston, because the media is the media. They want to, it's all out there to sell product, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting thing. So for us, it's like, what sponsors do we need to bring the visibility? How do we kind of become the main thing? Because obviously, one of the issues in Connecticut is also we have a large professional college basketball team in terms of their lore and pedigree. And so if you have to make the option and say, well, there's a game happening at the same time, or there's like training camp, where do you go? And at their schedule, the women's schedule caters to what happens in the summer. A lot of folks have more free time during the summer. But I think that becomes a challenge, because even in Boston, one of the drawbacks potentially could be is do you have direct sponsorships with the WNBA?
Yeah.
Or is this kind of more of a cohort where we're using media rights with the facilities, and how does that still provide traction? I think one of the also catalysts is that thinking about numbers is the two sold out games that happened. I think that we're seeing Boston as a viable space,
mm-hmm.
but really I think those were particular games that really spoke to, fandom,
sure.
or the Caitlin Clark.
Effect, yeah. Yeah.
Or the Los Angeles Sparks. And so when those two games were sold out in Boston, it gave this idea like, okay, we know we have to move venues because the facility we're playing at does not accommodate. But what does that mean from a regular season? Are you going to have fan attendance around 10, 12,000? Do you have to draft someone in? And what does free agency look like between Connecticut versus Boston? And so I do believe that comes into free agency for a lot of athletes saying, now that I have some autonomy to decide where I want to go and the best situation for myself, is Boston or is Connecticut the viable space? And I think that plays into some individual decisions.
Yeah, sure. And finally, Dr. McCauley, in about the minute we have left, that's a great segue. I was going to say, listen, with all due respect, you know, you have a young woman looking at, you know, a major market team, New York or Boston or Connecticut. And yeah, the casino is great and all the entertainment venues. But if you want to just kick back after a game and go hang at a club, I think we know where the better choices might be. No offense to our fine people that run the casinos here, but life is life, right? You just mentioned that. People want to be where, you know, forgive the term, but yeah, let me go where some of the action is. And, you know, the Mohegans and Foxwoods may be great, but it ain't New York, L.A., or Boston.
I think that, and that also, that describes the sporting culture. So we know that when we leave a game in Boston, there are different pubs, there are different social events, people are watching different games, and so the culture and the constellation of sport means something different. I mean, not to slight the casino and gambling that's happening,
yeah.
But everyone else is there for different reasons. And so you have a team where we hope that Connecticut has loyal fan base. And so how does that help those individuals say, well, you know, maybe I can travel to some games in Boston, watch it, viewership.
Mm-hmm.
But the sporting community across Boston is distinctly different. I mean, and even the college spaces. And so we see the high schools,
yeah.
We see some of the colleges. And so this is going to draw more individuals to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is a larger community than what Connecticut has to offer.
Sure, sure. Thanks much to Dr. Don McCauley. He's an assistant professor of management and also specializes in sports management at Quinnipiac University. Dr. McCauley, good to chat with you. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it. There you go. The president, Mr. Trump, firing the woman who puts together or leads the or did lead the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who always crank out some stats, including the monthly jobs report. Most people would see it and go, all right, it's up, it's down, whatever. But not now, after he fired the woman late last week. Who's the head of the BLS putting those numbers out, and some people are outraged, and the Trump crowd loves it. So where do we stand on that? CBS News White House reporter Willie James Inman is joining us on that. Willie, good afternoon. Good to have you. And I guess, Willie, a lot of other people that are not in the business like you and I are now looking at this saying, hey, wait a minute, there was a person behind these numbers? What's the reaction been in D.C.?
Yeah, that's right, Paul. A lot of everyday folks might not know that there is a whole team of individuals at the Department of Labor, in this case at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that compile information, compile data, and essentially send out those monthly job numbers that we see. And this past Friday, the job numbers showed that 73,000 jobs were added to the U.S. economy last month. And this really caught the interest of President Trump, who decided to fire Erica McIntyre, who is the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, we've seen a range of responses from lawmakers on Capitol Hill. You have, for the most part, Democrats blasting the president for doing this. There are also some members of the president's party who were calling into question his actions here. But there are some Republicans who support the president's decision to do this. And the White House is, in fact, defending this decision. Mm-hmm. We saw President Trump defend the decision over the weekend, and a White House official telling CBS News today that the fired BLS commissioner was not a nonpartisan technocrat. but instead calling her a Biden appointee who previously served as a Biden economic advisor. So really is a range of responses, but still nonetheless, the president says that he will replace her in the coming days.
Yeah, and Willie, finally, the most interesting, I guess, aspect I've seen of this, and you've probably heard it down there as well, some of the people, Willie, who criticize this say they go back to the old phrase or the old idea you and I have heard, right? Just because you get bad news, you fire the messenger. And so I guess that might be their most effective argument against what Mr. Trump did.
Yeah, that's right, because it's important to point out that the commissioner, while she was the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, she's not in charge of necessarily changing the numbers or anything like that. What the president is alleging here is that the numbers were somehow a scam, somehow that the numbers were changed or there's an effort to make it appear to be in favor of one party or the other. Now, the White House hasn't provided that evidence to us, at least, and those numbers are often revised down or up. We've seen that in previous months. We've seen them revised drastically up or downwards, but still, nonetheless, the president making this decision. But it really puts the question out there. Should the Department of Labor use better ways to gather data? That is something that economists have been talking about on the airwaves. But lawmakers, at least, for their part, are concerned that the president is going political here with a position that really, if you rely on the data, is not political data. So that's the major concern that we're hearing, at least from most Democratic lawmakers and at least some Republicans, Paul.
CBS News White House reporter Willie James Inman. Willie, thank you. We appreciate it. Look forward to speaking again. Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Thanks. CBS News White House reporter in D.C., Willie James Inman.